You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Priyanka Chopra on the cover. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Now, here's the editor's letter from Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief. In the photos, Radhika Jones at LACMA's Art and Film Gala, presented by Gucci in Los Angeles. Vanity Fair's Awards Insider issue featuring Katrina Balfe of Belfast and other Oscar contenders. I visited Los Angeles a few months ago for the first time since February 2020. It was wonderful to see our Hollywood writers and editors in person and to feel the excitement around all the excellent movies coming out this fall and winter. I've been going to screenings in New York and have been so happy to reconnect with that state of emerging from a dark theater into the afternoon sunlight, still shaking off the imagined world you've inhabited for the last couple of hours. The disconnect between a city street and a cinematic universe only makes the film's impression stronger. As a person who remembers the advent of the VCR, it still seems like a miracle that I can watch so many movies anytime at home. But with the requisite precautions in place, I've been extra glad to get back to the theater. Our Awards Insider team is covering this season as only Vanity Fair can, with daily updates on critic-bestowed honors, the state of the Oscar race, and expert insights into all the filmmaking components that come together to make a contender. Our first of two special issues this season features Belfast Katrina Balfe, star of the cult favorite Outlander, whose performance in Kenneth Branagh's film about the Troubles has brought her new acclaim and further kindled her ambitions in acting and directing. It was a fun and busy week in L.A. At the LACMA Art and Film Gala, I had the pleasure of seeing artist Amy Sherald and Kehinde Wiley honored, alongside Steven Spielberg. And I caught up with Priyanka Chopra Jonas at a party she and her husband Nick Jonas hosted for Diwali. There were warm and welcoming lights all the way up the driveway, and everybody danced, and it felt like we all had reason to celebrate. As Rebecca Ford writes in her cover story, Priyanka enters 2022 with her cup overflowing. Projects ranging from her recent turn in The Matrix Resurrections to new productions with Amazon Studios to her first Hindi film in a number of years, which she'll shoot in India alongside two Bollywood actors. Listening to her, you get the sense she's a woman at the top of her game who is also, in her own words, at a precipice of reinvention. Thank you. now for some of the contributors to this issue. Yuko Shimizu, What Lies Beneath. I didn't even know I wanted to illustrate an 18th century sea battle until this project, says Shimizu, whose art accompanies Julian Sancton's story of an extraordinary shipwreck off the coast of Colombia. Shimizu found inspiration in unexpected places. Maybe it's a sign I should pay a visit, but not to look for the treasure, that's for sure. Rebecca Ford, Everything's Coming Up, Priyanka. I admire the path Priyanka has taken from Bollywood star to Hollywood actress, especially because this industry does not have a history of holding the door open, says Vanity Fair senior Hollywood correspondent. During their interviews, Ford bonded with Chopra Jonas over their Asian mother's knack for reorganizing their kitchens behind their backs. William Wegman, Just for Kicks. Wegman is world-renowned for replacing the typical fashion subject with his own Weimaraners. I have two dogs, Flo and Topper. Flo made it very clear that she was going to be the one in this photo. In Flo's mind, she nailed it, he says of this month's gallery page, shot in his inimitable style. Janine DeGiovanni, Generation Gaza. The award-winning war correspondent and author of the recently published book, The Vanishing, has reported on Gaza for more than 30 years. I dream of a day when Gazans can live a life of dignity, she says, reflecting on her new story about the region's vibrant youth culture. Fatima Speer, Generation Gaza. A 24-year-old self-taught photojournalist, Speer documents conflict and tragedy in her native Palestine. For Vanity Fair, she captured the spirit of Gaza's inspiring and tenacious youth. Despite all the negativity in the city, she says, I discovered examples of creative, ambitious people fighting in their own world for a better future. Jamila Lemieux, Dave Chappelle's Big Lie. The stakes are incredibly high, says the writer and cultural critic about her piece grappling with Dave Chappelle's controversial stand-up special. I hope black men understand how much I love them, despite having to make some uncomfortable observations about the ways they've been able to treat black women and LGBTQ folks, she says. A Beautiful Mind. In a new book, the inspiration and impetus behind Nikki de St. Phalle's artwork is on display by Keziah Weir. In the photos, Californian Diary, Queen Califia, 1994, Double Tête, 1999, what is now known was once only imagined. I would like to unlock the closed doors and windows of my mind, 1974, by Nikki de St. Phalle. All artwork pictured here, courtesy Nikki Charitable Art Foundation. The accounting of a life is not the simple accounting of facts, writes Nicole Rudick in the introduction to her new book, What is Now Known Was Once Only Imagined, an autobiography of Nikki de St. Phalle, out from Celio. Rudick weaves selections from the Nikki Charitable Art Foundation, the Franco-American artist published and previously unseen letters, memoirs, art, and sketches into a posthumous narrative. A ghostly collaboration, free of commentary and interpretation, with the artist herself. It's left to the reader to connect St. Phalle's Nana figures, colorful, curvaceous, and taking up space, with her lifelong interrogation of what it means to be a woman. I got the message that men had power, and I wanted it, she wrote in a 1991 letter to a curator, but later describes her guilt at abandoning my children for my work, the way men often do. Likewise, St. Phalle notes that Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man made her hyper-aware of America's systemic racism. 30 years later, she would write and illustrate a book called AIDS, You Can't Catch It Holding Hands. What is now known contains disturbing biographical details, including St. Phalle's painful account of her father raping her when she was 11. Her anger and the exorcism of it manifested in so-called shooting paintings, sculptural canvases of found objects, paint-filled balloons, and spray paint cans covered in white. She'd shoot them and colors would drip like blood. These works culminated in her 1972 film Daddy, a Sylvia Plath-esque exploration of patricide. It's not your moment any longer, Daddy, she says. We intend to enjoy our freedom and our power as you enjoyed yours. Show and Tell, a vaunted bookseller takes the art world by storm, by Nate Freeman. In the photo, an NOI officer and Korean War vet, 2021, by Marcus Brutus, on view at Harper's Chelsea 512. Last October, the gallerist Harper Levine opened an opulent new space in Los Angeles, the latest move in a rapid rise up the art world ladder. For years, Levine was content as the proprietor of Harper's Books, a small East Hampton purveyor of rare volumes. Bill Clinton was a notable client, as is the artist Richard Prince. But in 2013, despite having no formal art training, he started staging exhibitions at the store. The Irish artist Janvier Figuis, an early find, labored in obscurity until Prince noticed her on Twitter and gushed to his bookseller. Levine sold her work for less than $10,000. Now a Figuis painting might go for $180,000 at auction. In 2016, Levine opened a small by-appointment gallery on the Upper East Side, and at the end of 2020, a location on the same West 22nd Street block as Hauser & Wirth and Matthew Marks. This March, the gallery expands to a second, larger space down that street with an inaugural show of new paintings by Marcus Brutus, a self-taught star in the making, found again through social media and an artist referral. Levine saw a painting on Jennifer Guidi's Instagram and DM'd immediately. Since then, Brutus has shown twice in the Hamptons, but of the Chelsea solo exhibition, Levine says, Marcus has seen his career blossom over the past few years, and now he's ready for prime time. So, it appears, is Levine. Sexual healing. With Sephora's expansion into vibrators and new sex sundries this month, whole body health comes into focus by Laura Regensdorf. Opening photograph of a couple embracing by Lati Van Ralty. In other photos, early vibrators were marketed sometimes with coded allusions as beauty remedies, echoed in this 1920s photo of an actor. Sex and the City gave Outre Erotica primetime exposure, with an emphasis on pleasure for all. Maud launched in 2018, positioning sex essentials as wellness. Dakota Johnson joined founder Eva Goycochea, pictured here in 2020, amid a surge in self-care interest, and the three-speed vibe, available at Sephora. In 1998, an animal previously associated with screwball animation, Roger Rabbit, Bugs Bunny, had a public coming of age. Partway through season one of Sex and the City, Miranda leads her friends to the Pleasure Chest, a sex shop in the West Village, to show them the rabbit. A vibrator, cartoonish in design, but apparently deft, It's pink for girls, purrs Charlotte upon first sight, before falling so in its thrall that she needs an intervention. The morning after the episode aired, a line snaked outside San Francisco's Good Vibrations, the boutique opened in 1977 by sex educator Joni Blank. The rabbits, as Aesop could have guessed, went fast. Vibrators, of course, were nothing new. Good Vibrations displays a cache of antique examples. Dr. Mercara's Pulsicon from the Gilded Age. The 1920s Polar Cub. You just had to go on an odyssey to find them. I remember the Hustler store on Sunset. All the photographs of women on boxes of products were so insane, says Dakota Johnson, describing how it all felt geared toward a certain made-up female. By the fall of 2020, when the actor joined the sexual wellness startup Maud as co-creative director, the landscape was swiftly changing. Online shopping had destigmatized the browsing experience. Maud's vibe ushered in an aesthetic more in tune with Brancusi forms. It was as if the push for sex positivity with its candy-colored innuendo was sliding into neutral toward normalcy. And all the way to Sephora, where the category debuts on its U.S. website this month. Landing at the beauty mecca was part of Maud founder Eva Goicoechea's vision from day one, she says, of her intent to redefine the sex toy space. As she told me in 2018, something like 70% of women don't orgasm during sex, so it's an essential item. Maud's range of bath soaks and oils reinforced this notion of well-being. During the pandemic, a wash and self-care talk, the wait list for the Vibe topped 25,000. Its second vibrator drop, shaped like a beauty blender and billed as an all-body massager for its erogenous zone versatility, arrived last March. How have we managed to be this prudish this long? It was 1980 when Dr. Ruth Westheimer brought her German accent and chipmunk laugh to a new late-night radio show, Sexually Speaking. In those years, people did not talk openly about orgasm. They did not talk openly about sex education, recalls Dr. Ruth, 93. Now, orgasm is the name of NARS's best-selling blush. Sex Education, starring Gillian Anderson as an Esther Perel-style therapist, is a Netflix hit. There are still taboos, including older people's desire, a subject that Dr. Ruth took care to represent in her revised edition of The Art of Arousal, Abbeville Press, an art historical romp. I want to teach again that sex does not have to be in porno shops, she says, and it does not have to be at a quarter after midnight. The topic of sex remains charged, but public access, in retail, on TV, has a real-life effect. A few seasons after Sex and the City's Rabbit episode, Samantha goes to replace her microphone-shaped AccuVibe. Sharper Image doesn't sell vibrators. It's a neck massager, the humorless sales clerk says. But a modern-day Samantha might pick up a new model along with the latest cult face cream and head back out on the town. First Love. From SoundCloud throngs to Grammy voters, everyone swooning for Giveon. By Britt Hinemuth. The Grammy-nominated newcomer is reinvigorating R&B, referencing Frank Sinatra as an inspiration, and collaborating with superstars like Justin Bieber and Drake. Though he's still waiting on that call from Adele, this year his debut album arrives. Growing up, the Long Beach native was the middle child of seven. His mother ruled the roost. She wanted me to be a giving person, which is why he's named Giveon. She also recognized his gifts early and encouraged him to sing at birthday parties. All the other kids are jumping in the bounce house eating candy. I'm in the bathroom doing vocal exercises. Before breaking big, I was a server at Bubba Gump Shrimp Company. On slow days, I would have to put on the shrimp suit, stand in front of the restaurant, kids pulling my tail. He also walked dogs. My favorite was a husky named Snoop, before a producer found him on SoundCloud. He recorded his first professional single on the eve of a big moment. The producer asked how old he was, and I was like, I'm 23. And then I looked at the clock, and it was 12:01 a.m. I was like, I'm actually 24. Having never drunk before, he took a celebratory shot of water and soon signed a record deal. 1 year later, he released his first EP and had his first sip of rosé, was nominated for a Grammy, and collaborated with Bieber on Peaches, 2021's Song of the Summer. The fashion world has come calling as well, and Giveon welcomes it. He's just returning from a trip to Paris with Chanel. Music is just 50%, he says. Fashion is a huge way to tell the story. After a bit more experimenting, Pinot Grigio is now his drink of choice. When he's not touring North America or rehearsing for his AMA performance, he's rereading Mark Manson's The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F and trying to find time for a family reunion on an island. His upcoming album is the story of the last 18 months of my life. I don't know how to be within this new existence and still try to live the same life. New and novel, fresh fiction worthy of topping the to-read list by Keziah Weir. To Paradise, in two alternative histories, 1893-1993, and one terrifying projection, 2093, Hanya Yanagihara presents a strange, brilliant triad with recurring motifs. Plague, marriage, and a Greenwich Village townhouse. Published by Doubleday. Pure Color, Mira, a critic in training, subsumes the soul of her dead father and is dazzled by a compelling older artist in Sheila Hetty's fable, a bestiary light love letter to the art of life. Published by FSG. FUCCBOI, Shanthor Conroy presents a lit grad in Philadelphia as he makes deliveries, debates the isms, race, sex, class, capital, juggles bays, and writes it all down in fresh prose, colloquial and poetic, published by Little Brown. Olga Dies Dreaming, in Xochitl Gonzalez's gripping debut, the shadow of their absent mother, a Puerto Rican independence activist, looms over the political and personal choices of two adult siblings living in Brooklyn. Published by Flatiron. Just for Kicks by Miles Pope, with a photograph by William Wegman, showing a Weimaraner with an Hermes Ballide skate bag and finger skate bag accessory. In the mid-1960s, skateboarding took the world by storm, from Venice Beach to the Lower East Side. Riding was and continues to be a symbol of escapism. This new Hermes Bolide bag pays homage. Its leather and aluminum base is printed with a street art-inspired design from one of the brand's silk collections, and a finger skate board dangles from the handle. Surf that asphalt. And trending, Blue Jean Baby, to celebrate Dolly Parton's debut novel, Run, Rose, Run, co-written by James Patterson, and out from Little Brown next month, along with a 12-song album, Drape Yourself in Denim and Diamonds. Valentino Shirt, Carolina Herrera Skirt, Maison Michel Hat, Louis Vuitton Men's Hoodie, Himmerly Earrings, The Laundress Denim Care Set, Alexander McQueen Bra, Elia Fullest Volumizing Mascara, Gabriella Hearst Pants, Capitol Jeans, Fendi Bag, Brent Neal Ring, and Lurida Flats, all pictured here in denim blue. Paris, je t'aime. As the market for luxury travel resurges, James Reginato visits a hotel nonpareil in the city that has launched 1,000 fantasies. With illustrations by Cassandre Montorial. Opening illustration, Cheval Blanc Paris guests enjoy views of the Eiffel Tower and Notre Dame. For some of the world's most fashionable folk, the music stopped exactly 2 years ago in Paris. On the first day of the season's ready-to-wear shows, 14 cases of coronavirus were reported in France. A week later, the collections lurched to a halt, and so did the world as we knew it. Now, whether because of a certain bingeable Netflix series or simple nostalgia for the city that has long served as the platonic ideal of a fantasy vacation, we're all yearning to get back to Gay Paris. As we hedge our way through variants and scientific breakthroughs, what better grail for travelers in search of lost time than the City of Light? No hotel exemplifies the city's reawakening quite like Cheval Blanc Paris, which LVMH chief executive Bernard Arnault opened this fall, though its gestation began more than 15 years before, when LVMH acquired a majority stake in the department store Le Samaritain, housed in a sprawling two-block complex in the first arrondissement, one of the city's oldest neighborhoods. As plans slowly and arduously moved forward to restore the central building, a study in Art Nouveau, back to its glory as a temple of commerce, Arnault conceived of a separate purpose for the Art Deco sister space that fronts the Seine, capitalizing on its spectacular, uninterrupted views. That vision was for Paris's only five-star riverfront hotel, a showcase for the art de vivre of France that would, as Arnault said, symbolize French luxury. It also has the distinction of being the city's only hotel of its caliber with a French owner. Much of the execution of Arnault's vision fell to architect Peter Marino, who has virtually redefined high-end retail with the stores he has designed, including the airy Louis Vuitton space in Los Angeles and the geometric Chanel building in Seoul. Marino spent nearly a decade marshaling the talents of some 600 French artisans and artists for Cheval Blanc Paris. Every aspect, from the furniture to the fabric, was custom-made for the property's public spaces, four restaurants, and 72 rooms and suites. Rates start at about $1,500 a night. Sumptuous goatskin parchment upholstered the intricate wingewood cabinetry in the large dressing room of my suite. Who would have imagined coming to Paris and not wanting to leave your closet? The property is Cheval Blanc's first urban location, following 2006's inaugural ski lodge in Courcheval and subsequent resorts in Saint-Barts, Saint-Tropez, and the Maldives. A collection that speaks to the future of LVMH, whose growing hospitality division signals that luxury is still and increasingly experiential. In 2019, the company paid $3.2 billion for Belmond and its 46 fabled hotels, cruises, trains, and restaurants. Three of its Italian hotels stayed open throughout the winter last year due to demand, effectively doing away with the idea of a European off-season. Meanwhile, the 115-room Cheval Blanc Beverly Hills is set to open in 2025. The Paris Hotel features museum-quality works of art, commissioned pieces from Vic Muniz, Frank Gehry, and Ingrid Donat, an enormous abstract canvas by Georges Mathieu in the lobby, a red monochrome James Sienna in a sitting room, lithographs by Sonia Delaunay in the hallways. It's as good a time as any to display the incredible talents of French artisans, Marino says. LVMH's luxury arsenal runs the gamut of interest, and a selection of the conglomerate's 75 brands turns up at the new hotel. Next illustrations. The ground floor houses Limbar, a tea room presided over by Maxime Friedrich, former pastry chef at Georges V. Paris. Alongside the longest indoor pool in Europe is the Dior Spa, replete in luxe treatment options. Guillaume Henry, artistic director of Patou, designed the staff uniforms in matte wool, cotton piqué, and poplin. Cheval Blanc's Langosteria restaurant pours bottles of Dom Pérignon and Château d'Yquem, both Moët Hennessy labels, while vitrines in the lobby showcase Tiffany jewels. Inside the gloriously restored Samaritain Emporium, which opened to much fanfare last summer, the company has counted some 35,000 pouring into the panoply of LVMH stores each day. Cheval Blanc's VIP guest can access Le Samaritain through a private entrance and skip the lines. The ultimate brand synergy awaits in the Dior Spa. Housed on the lower level, along with the longest indoor pool in Europe. Treatments include a couture dream, during which six hands simultaneously work their magic on one lucky client's hair, face, hands, and feet, giving new meaning to Evita's entreaty via Andrew Lloyd Webber, "So Christian Dior me from my head to my toes." 2 years out from hosting the 2024 Summer Olympics, the city's awakening seems to be on hyperdrive. Only a few blocks from Cheval Blanc lies another of Paris's biggest new draws, the Bourse de Commerce, the handiwork of France's other king of luxury, Kering founder François Pinault, who, with Japanese architect Tadao Ando, spent 5 years transforming the monumental old stock exchange building into a showcase for contemporary masterpieces from the Pinault collection. On its top floor at Al Ougain, father and son chefs Michel and Sébastien Bras serve earthy and poetic cuisine. Across town, in the 8th arrondissement's luxe golden triangle, the magnificent Hôtel de Marine, built by Louis XV on the Place de la Concorde, and long the headquarters of France's naval ministry, has emerged from a painstaking refurbishment. For the first time in more than 200 years, its sumptuous staterooms are open to the viewing public. Under the same roof, in a series of modernist gallery rooms, the Altani collection, inaugurated in November, showcases treasures from the ancient world, collected by Sheikh Hamad bin Abdullah Altani, a member of Qatar's royal family. As Audrey Hepburn famously declared, Paris is always a good idea. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.